Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, Ruckers. The final fallow is far beyond us now. It's Monday morning. We're back, as there are two rounds left in the Six Nations. And the great question is for this week, can anyone stop Ireland? Yes, this is The Ruck from The Times and The Sunday Times. And we've got a superb panel for you. Two of our panellists are British and Irish Lions and Grand Slam winners. Together, they've got 116 caps for their country. And neither of them are Alex Lowe. Sorry, Alex, that's a bit unfair, isn't it? Did you have a good fallow weekend?
I did, yeah. I loved it. I actually took my son to play rugby on Sunday. It was lovely to just be at home. But I do, when you've introduced the other guests, I would like to know whether everyone enjoys a fallow weekend at Six Nations or not, because they're going to drop one of them, and I think that would be a good thing. It just stalls the momentum. I would have liked this to have been a Six Nations weekend.
Well, why don't we ask one of our esteemed British and Irish Lions that we've teed up. With us down the line from the house that Turnover's built is Times columnist and top rucker Sam Warburton. Morning, Sam. You right?
Yeah, I've just come from finishing Jacqueline in my back garden with some tackle pads and stuff. 6 years after my retirement, I can't let it go.
did you enjoy the fallows? Was it a chance to physically refresh, or did sometimes you think it killed the momentum a bit of a tournament when you had sort of two games break, one match break, two games?
Yeah, I agree with Alex. 1 week is a lovely break. Maybe after round three, maybe go 3 weeks and then you have like a break. And then, but to go fallow game fallow, it did feel like a bit of a drag, this part of the Six Nations. You just wanted the games to come. I think having 1 week off is very important just for some recuperation. I always said the autumn internationals for Wales, anyway, because they've always played historically four tests. That was the hardest international campaign, because four international games in a row, 4 weekends in a row, was always brutal. So to do five would be too much. But I think if you split it three, gap two, then I think that's absolutely fine. So I agree. One final week is enough. This would have been lovely to have been an international weekend.
What did you do with your weekend off, Sam?
As a player, you mean, or just gone?
No, just gone, I was thinking.
Oh, just gone, yeah. It was my first weekend
watching
off
Spurs
with the
or
kids
something?
It was my first weekend off with the kids for goodness knows how long. I obviously do rugby. I try not to do more than maybe 30 weekends a year, 20 weekends a year of rugby. Right. Otherwise, I don't want to be that vacant dad. I'm around in the weekdays a little bit to do school runs, which is the nice side. But I was just home this weekend, which was lovely. Take the little kids out on their bikes, play football with them, or rugby, I should say.
But yeah, you're getting to the national home. Sport debate there. You don't want to start.
Oh, I know. I know. Well, people ask me if my kids play rugby yet. I'm like, oh, well, not 100% convinced I want them to look like me, to be honest. So if they want to play football, they can play football. But I just, lovely weekend with the kids, which is nice.
Well, look, I mentioned we had another top guest on the way, and he's coming soon. That's going to be Ireland's Tommy Bow, who will be on later to chat about England-Ireland. We'll also discuss Italy, Scotland, Wales, France too. Round up with our god or goddess of the week. But why don't we begin with Ireland's trip to Twickenham after this? Okay, so to join us to chat through the England-Ireland game as our second super guest, it's Tommy Bow. How's it going, Tommy?
Very well. Yeah, good to chat to you guys. Nice to join the pod. Hope you're well. I'm obviously an Irish man, very excited about this weekend.
I was going to ask you that, Tommy, because we've been talking about this on The Ruck in recent weeks. What sort of Irishman are you with the team winning all the time? Are you sort of the chest-out optimist who thinks nothing can go wrong from here? or the pessimist who thinks, oh, this run can't last forever?
It's funny, isn't it? We're totally not used to being the favourites going into these games and actually looking like we're going to, you know, people talk about a Grand Slam after just beating France. I mean, it is a bit crazy, the confidence that the Irish public have at the minute. But I think the Irish team are giving us that reason to be confident. They're playing some unbelievable rugby. They're, you know, amazing to watch. And, you know, new players coming into the setup. There was so many question marks when Johnny Sexton stepped away last summer or after the World Cup. Could Ireland perform to that level? But I think Crowley's come in. He stepped right up to the plate. Looks so comfortable. And it's given us every reason to be optimistic and confident. But we're still... we can't get too far ahead of ourselves because all of a sudden everybody throws it back to us, the quarterfinal. And yes, it still hurts and cuts deep that we've never got past a World Cup quarterfinal. But when it comes to Six Nations, we're looking pretty damn good at the minute.
Yeah, absolutely. What, like you've won a Grand Slam. Sam's won a Grand Slam. Like, winning one Grand Slam is hard enough, but winning two in a row is ridiculous, isn't it? Like, can you put into words what that would mean for the Irish team, Tommy?
It would be unbelievable. I mean, if you think about whenever I was part of the team to win the Grand Slam back in 2009, it was that final match against Wales. It came down to Stephen Jones kicking that kick 45 metres out and it just went short. That was the first Grand Slam that Ireland had won in 61 years. So it was an incredible moment. The country just went, you know, the champagne corks were popping. It was 2009. I think we were in the middle of the financial crash at that stage. So probably the days of champagne were gone. But the whole thing has just turned around. I mean, to not win a Six Nations in 61 years or Grand Slam, to now be going looking for a back-to-back Grand Slam, it is remarkable. And I think Joe Schmidt had a massive part of that to build the foundations. But what Andy Farrell is doing with the team just as, you know, it's taken them to the next level. And it's not just playing rugby, winning rugby. They're playing a really exciting, fun style of rugby that everybody is enjoying watching.
Sam, you won back-to-back titles, not quite the Slam, but we know how you did it in 13, having won the Slam in 12. Like, it's sort of an obvious thing to say that doubling up a Slam is a ridiculous achievement, but from your perspective as a player who's been in the middle of Slam-winning and Championship-winning campaigns too, can you sort of give us a sense of what that would mean for the player?
Well, I mean, what Ireland are on the brink of at the minute, I'm going to make Tommy feel even more uncomfortable because I'm going to make them even stronger favourites. If they do back-to-back slams, which has never been done before, you know, is this now the greatest Six Nations team we've ever seen? I mean, exclusively Six Nations. I mean, take away World Cup. I mean, just focus this on Six Nations. Even, you know, Martin Johnson's era of 03 didn't win back-to-back Grand Slams. And even the slams they did win, like, so far these three games, 21 points is the nearest someone's got close to Ireland. I'm not sure a team is going to come within 15 points of Ireland, and that's going to be back-to-back slams. I think by two scores, they could put that potentially. There's still two games to go, and England away will be tough, and Scotland at home. But if you're looking at the hard facts and the black and white of it in the cold light of day, Ireland should win, but I think, by two scores in both those games, which would make it the most convincing Grand Slam ever, back-to-back. You've probably got the best Six Nations teams of all time. So I think, given all that, that's the carrot that's dangling in front of them. It's a heck of a legacy to be able to leave behind if you're Irish. And to spare Tommy's blushes, I mean, Tommy's era, I thought, was an exceptional era and has probably inspired this young generation who actually managed to see Grand Slams being won. It's kickstarted them. So I'd have just gone from strength to strength. And I think we could be looking at potentially the greatest Six Nations team of all time.
Tommy, is the hallmark of this Ireland team the fact that Jack Crowley can come in the 10 jersey and just fit in so seamlessly to what they're doing, that he's dropped into a settled team with quality players who understand how to win, but he's taking the job of an Irish legend, a guy who's run that team, run that programme for so many years. The fact that Jack can just step in and pick up where Johnny Sexton left off, is that the hallmark of why this Ireland team is so good?
I think that's what's been most surprising to players like myself who played alongside Johnny, because Johnny, whenever he was the captain or the leader of our team in the number 10 jersey, everything went through him. He was so decisive in set plays, in making decisions on what calls were going to be made, even during the week, and setting the standards. So I definitely felt there was going to be a drop-off in this Irish team because Johnny Sexton is just so influential, but it's really blown me away to think that it's actually the structure that's been put in place by the coaches, that players can actually just drop in and drop out. And somebody as influential and as important as Johnny Sexton to that Irish setup was going into the World Cup, that actually we didn't have to rely on him as much. And maybe even going into that quarterfinal, whenever he looked like his legs were spent at 60 minutes, maybe they could have brought Crowley on, and he could have added an injection of energy. So it's really exciting. It's interesting that, and you have to put a huge amount of credit down to the likes of Andy Farrell and Mike Catt in setting up the game, that everybody just seems to be able to slot in and out and know exactly what they're doing. And you compare it to France, who obviously are missing DuPont in this Six Nations, and they just looked rudderless without him. I was there the first match, Ireland against France in Marseille. I was expecting the French team to really a huge backlash after the disappointment of the World Cup, but they just looked directionless. They just didn't know where they were going. And I think that they're a team that are struggling without their talisman, where I think Ireland are thriving under this new regime and new crew coming through.
Do you think, we'll joke at the start about the optimists and the pessimists, but do you feel that the structure and the system that Ireland now have in place from what Joe Schmidt put in place with the Ireland team that Andy Farrell's taken on, but the pyramid below it will allow for sustainable success? This isn't just a wave to be ridden until it crashes on the beach. So actually, this could be something that, yeah, that Ireland could be threatening at not just for Grand Slams, but at the top of the world rankings for a long time to come.
I think if you look at the success of the Irish under-20s in the last couple of years, there's no doubt that there is a succession plan and so many young players coming through the system. There's a big question mark in Ireland with many of these young players coming through the Leinster schoolboy rugby system. Where are they going to get the matches? Because it's very difficult to usurp Hugo Keenan and so many of these other players who've got their places solidified in the Leinster setup. The big thing we do need to remember is that this Six Nations, the competition probably isn't where it has been in years gone by. The England team is not as settled and does not look as confident as English teams in years gone by. Wales, similar. They've got Warren Gatland back, but they're bringing through so many young players. France just looked like a completely different beast to what we've seen the last couple of years. And I suppose Scotland really favoured themselves. They'd be really excited going to Dublin on the last weekend of the Six Nations, thinking that they can cause an upset. But I think, given the recent history between Ireland and Scotland, Ireland would be still confident. So, Sam, listen, it's unbelievably flattering. I think that Ireland, this team, will be right up there when push comes to shove in one of the greatest teams. But you do always got to take in the competition. And I was talking about Max Verstappen this morning. I mean, listen, he's walking away with the Formula One at the minute, but he's not really been pushed. And it's hard to say he's one of the best if you're not having that sort of battle, which what this Irish team really need.
If we flip it around, guys, I'm really interested in sort of England's psychology this week, and bring in Sam on this, like, with your kind of player and analyst hat on. How do you beat Ireland? Like, it's a mad question, is it? Because I'm looking at the statistics. They've lost 2 of their last 20 and 3 of their last 34 tests. So it doesn't happen often. But what are you seeing when you're watching these Ireland games, Sam, about how you go about beating them?
Well, I think the important thing to do, and I think one of the common mistakes that a lot of people make when they try and play any of the top teams in the world, is they try and match fire with fire. Ireland play the way Ireland play because that's their strength. You don't suddenly say, right, we have to try and play more expansive open rugby, because Ireland are doing it and it works, because South Africa are like, well, no, we play our style to the best that we can and we win. And New Zealand say, we play our style to the best and we win. So I think it's important England don't get wrapped up and think, oh, well, we have to then play more expansive. England aren't overnight going to be suddenly a 3-4 try team, which is what you've got to be to beat Ireland. But what they can do in 2 weeks is limit Ireland to maybe 2 tries. That's going to be their best chance. That's what they're going to have to focus on. So England, I've always said this, England have to be England. Whether they've got the players or not to do this right now is up for debate. But England are good when they receive kickoff, set up a maul, maul at the pitch, penalty, line out, create another maul, box kick, kick chase, win the aerial battle. That's England. That's when England look good. They haven't really delivered that. It looked like they were getting to those, well, that sort of team during the World Cup. But I think with Ireland, they're a team who enjoy high ball in play time. They enjoy going through plenty of time in attack. they haven't been getting challenged on the game lineup, the breakdown, because they've been so good there. So there's so many moving parts to Peel Island because they're that good. But yeah, I just think you've got to try and limit set piece. You've got to be ridiculously aggressive in your first three phase defense, because if they start snowballing through multi-phase, it becomes so difficult. And you have to play, which is where I do England get stick, and I think it is the right game plan on occasions. I might overplay it. You have to play territory against Ireland. You have to turn their wingers. You have to kick in behind them. You have to ask them to have high pressure exit lineouts and try and force errors that way. So yeah, there's no one masterful answer I can give you, or one short answer, because it's not that simple. But a lot of moving parts they have to get fixed, which is why I think Ireland will win. I think England can do good, because England can reach certain emotional peaks during the season where they just have this big physical performance. I do see improvements in their defence. You know, Scotland found it very difficult to go past two or three passes. And it reminds me of, and Tommy will remember this, from 2013. I remember a drill in the Lions in 2013 we used to do with Andy Fowler's defence coach, and he wanted our line speed to be so aggressive that the attack couldn't even go past two or three passes. You just cut it off. And that's what England managed to do to Scotland. Scotland couldn't go more than two or three passes in phase play. Their three tries came from counter-attack, moments of brilliance, and a line break from a missed tackle. So multi-phase, they actually couldn't stress England. So England's multi-phase defence is getting better, but it's going to face a different beast in Ireland. So, lots of things you've got to do right. There's lots of things you've got to do right.
I agree with you, Sam. I think that England don't have to try and pull a rabbit out of a hat. You think about this Irish team where they lost against New Zealand in the World Cup, the Leinster teams that have lost in European Cup finals, teams that get over the top of their set piece, so dismantle their line out, their scrum. And I think Joe Schmidt worked out what ruck it was. He'd nearly done every ream of look back at all Ireland's phase plays, and they seemed to target the right ruck. And maybe it was like the third phase where Ireland maybe just under-resourced a little bit to set up a play. And so if they can try and slow down their ball, and then the big thing for England, they've got to be clinical, because you know Ireland will score tries. If England get opportunities, they've got to score. So if they can do that, and I actually believe that whatever about Ireland's tack, there's so much talk about that, it's actually their defence which has been the most remarkable. The way they've kept teams out in really difficult moments has been pretty inspiring.
Just to put some statistics on that chat, guys, that I was looking, because I'm trying to do a piece on this week for the Times, on how do you beat Ireland, or what do the stats say about when Ireland lose, what happens. And obviously it's a small data set, because there's only four games in the last 2.5 years or so, but it's interesting to see what things teams get right when they beat Ireland. So as Sam, you said there, you've got to take your chances. So when Ireland win, they score at 2.8 points per entry, which is a pretty high level, and they concede 1.4 points per entry. But when they lose, the team that beats them scores at 4.3 tries an entry. So you've basically got to score a try every time you get in their 22, because you're not getting in them often. And then the turnover one that Tommy, you mentioned there, yeah. So Ireland concede about 5 turnovers a match when they win, but they concede about 7 turnovers a match when they lose. So that jackal threat is key, which maybe points to some England selection things, Alex, of whether we're thinking about George Martin or Lee Chesson for physicality, but maybe they want an extra jackler in there.
For me, it's a fascinating balance, because you guys mentioned the need to get on top of them and set piece. So they want George Martin, I think, second row for his power, scrummaging power, as well as his tackling power. And maybe Ollie Chesson playing 6 for the line-out threat. But then that might reduce their jackaling threat by having more of a second row playing at 6. How they strike that balance to be able to compete in all those areas, it will be, I guess, giving Steve Borthwick headaches this week, because he needs to try and target those areas. And yet, I'm not sure he's quite got the ideal personnel. Like, if he goes one way, they're slightly weaker as a jackal threat. They go the other way, they don't pose as many questions in the lineup.
Yeah, the other couple of things about scoring points, which is kind of obvious, and it was something that we'd always used to say when the All Blacks couldn't lose, you just got to score a lot of points. Like, the teams that beat Ireland score about 28 points and more than 3 tries. That, Sam, that doesn't look like something that England are capable of doing, on recent evidence at least.
This is why I'm a massive advocate of kicking 3 points. You just said then about points per entry, 2.8. Well, if you're playing then, if we're going to play the odds game, if England are getting, like they got turned over 20 times against Scotland. Now, they weren't all 20 times in kickable situations. They weren't 20 penalties they turned down. But if you're given 3 points in the game in Six Nations, that's not a bad return. 3 points is quite a good return to get to a 22. And I think a lot of teams play that. And look, sometimes it works. Sometimes you go to the corner and you score and it works. But it just shows, I think, 3 points. When you look at the stats, you look at red zone entries, 3 points are golden. And it's kind of proved it with England played it perfectly in the World Cup when it was Argentina. You go 3-6-9 through drop goals. And then that's what scoreboard pressure is then. Because when you're in the lead and you're a player and you're looking up at the big screen, like, crikey, we're 9 points down. It only takes one person out of that 15 to maybe step outside the circle or step outside the game plan, maybe run a ball back from deep that he was meant to kick, and then you get turned over again and you get a bit of a negative spiral. That's why it's so important, I find, to build a scoreboard. And just on those stats that you picked out, Alex, I was looking at... I do focus on defence a lot against Ireland because their attack is so good. Line breaks when they win is 7. They get 7 line breaks when they win a game. When they lose, it's limited to 4. That's much easier said than done, but that's where Ireland are excellent. We see that sort of three-pod play where they've got 4 options. Ball carrier can either take it himself, he's got inside, he's got outside, or he's got a back attached at the back. And that's almost like the forward doesn't even need to look behind when he pulls that ball back. He just knows that back is almost sitting 45-degree angle behind him, like within 2 metres. He can just flick it behind him. Be able to read that and stop those line breaks, because whenever Ireland get a line break, they're very clinical with it. If they don't score off the line break, then it'll at least give them some territory and it forces sort of pressure. So that's why I just think what England's, and just back on what Tommy said again, with England not trying to pull a rabbit out of the hat, what England need to do is try and just reduce that and stop that. And that's where I think their defence is going to be enormous. And if you could reduce those line breaks against Ireland from good defensive reads, good collision, which is another interesting debate with, you know, do you go with a 6 or a Jacqueline? I personally think Jacqueline and competing at the breakdown, you look at the best teams in the world, that's a team mindset. Say when I was playing and Wales did well, they go, oh yeah, Sam won the breakdown battle. I mean, no, it wasn't me, it was a team effort. I can only be at the biggest games. I would compete at maybe 15 rucks. That's only 15 rucks, and that would be a huge game where I've competed. You need everybody to contribute 3, 4, 5 times. When you do that across a team, that's when you become really difficult to break down in defence. So I think England need to take on more of a team mindset. Can't just rely on Earl or Underhill to try and get over that ball. It's got to be, everybody's got to dip in 2 or 3 times. If you do that collectively, then you've got some big numbers.
Yeah, I'm the same. Sam, whenever I scored the winning try, I always said, oh, it's a team effort, guys. Team effort. Well, no, I do agree with what you're saying, is that normally I'd be a big advocate for going to the corner, but the Irish team haven't been used to being behind and chasing a lead. You know, they very much get ahead and build that lead. So if there are 3 points on offer, I would imagine, you know, England will try and build the scorecard because, you know, to try and get themselves ahead.
Mind you, yeah, say that. I agree. Like with Ireland, I'd actually expect them to go to the corner, particularly if you've got a penalty in those 15, because they're so good in attack. England, because they're not that accurate in attack at the minute, and I think it's going to be very unlikely that's just going to completely turn on its head against Ireland. That's why if I was English, I'd be much more inclined to try and take threes when I can, unless you obviously, you know, you feel you've got real dominance in your maul or your scrum. That's a bit different. But I think Ireland could be much more gutsy and going for the corner because their attack is so good in the 22.
Tommy, you're a busy man, so I'll let you go in a second. But as the Irishman, I guess you'll be coming to Twickenham. What makes you, there's 4% or 2% fearful of England? Is there something in what you've seen from England so far that genuinely makes you think they could upset the odds here? Or are you coming to London pretty confident?
Listen, I'm coming very confident, but I know what a difficult place it is to go in Twickenham. We haven't always had the best record over there. And you got to look at this English team and Steve Borthwick. I mean, there's lots of question marks. Whenever I saw the squad was announced at the start, you think of the rugby that Northampton are playing and Harlequins, and these teams are playing such exciting rugby. You think, will England really open it up and try and get the best out of these players? And then, of course, Marcus Smith gets injured. Does Finn come in? So England have all the attacking elements and the big power and bulk and ability to shut down the breakdown. They have it all there to really make Ireland's trip to Twickenham a nightmare. So there's always that in the back of your mind. And I think there's no doubt that England always pull out a big performance, and this could be it, because against Ireland, people are writing them off at home. There's going to be a full house there. they would love nothing better than to send Ireland packing back home to Dublin again with their tails between their legs. But I think that this Irish team, we've been there before. And I just think with Andy Farrell, there's just a different mindset than the teams I would have been a part of in years gone by. So I think they'll still be confident. And for that reason, I will be too. But knowing that the challenge that lies ahead.
On that, is that a self-confidence, not arrogance, but a sort of self-belief, you mean, that Andy Farrell's instilled in the lads?
Yeah, no, without a doubt. Listen, he's played at the highest level, but I've never seen a squad that have more smiles on faces, that are unbelievably competitive with each other, but just thrive under the pressure. And so many times have been written off and questioned. And I particularly think that match in Marseille, I've never heard Le Marseillais at such a decibel level at the start of the Six Nations. And I thought this French team are going to come out of the traps and be hard. And Ireland just weathered the storm and then just came back and took them apart. So I just think that whatever he's built in this squad, there's just unbelievable resilience, and they can take whatever's thrown at them. And yeah, I don't think it's arrogance. I just think that they're playing at such a great level at the minute. It's a real joy to watch.
Yeah. Well, also, joy to have you on the pod, Tommy. Thanks for coming on. We'll let you head off. We'll do a couple more minutes on the England stuff. But for now, thank you very much for coming on The Ruck, Tommy.
Enjoy reading your pieces, and sure, have to listen to Warby. He's everywhere at the minute anyway. Cheers, guys. Thank you.
Awesome. Yeah, great to have Tommy Bow there. Busy man. So awesome to have 10-15 minutes of his time there. If we continue the chat on, the other element that England have struggled with against Ireland is getting players sent off. Three in a row. Charlie Yule's 22, Freddie Stewart 23, albeit rescinded post-match, and then Billy Vunipola in the warm-up game. You've got to keep men on the field, Sam. Like, that's obvious, another obvious thing to say, but you cannot afford a card against this Irish team.
Yeah, England's penalty count actually has been okay this campaign. I believe it's been in single figures for all three games, which is, you know, under 10 is the kind of, is the benchmark. So, I mean, that's good. I think the ones we're looking at, Ewells was the head contact, wasn't it? But even a polar, like, you wonder, are they slightly over-aroused emotionally? You know, like, you've got to be physical in these international games. And teams who've dominated Irish provinces or Irish teams, like South Africa's, like New Zealand when they just edged it in the World Cup, have won that physical battle. But I remember Sean Edwards was always calling it, like, intelligent aggression. Like, you've got to get to that precipice where you're so ruthlessly aggressive, but it can't spill over, you know. It's a difficult balance, that one, because, like you say, a penalty against Ireland, who were just, you know, defending with 15 is hard enough, never mind defending with 14. So that's, yeah, you're right, that's a must.
I mean, the game moves a million miles an hour out there, and there are a lot of dynamics that you can find yourself in a situation that you don't mean to be in very, very easily and accidentally go high. But one of the things I like about George Martin, if we think George Martin's going to start in the second row and bring the kind of physicality and dominance in the contact area, dominance in the tackle that he brought to the World Cup semi-final. What I like about him is that he technically hits really hard but low, and it's sort of Courtney Laws style approach to it, I think, where he can be physically dominant without putting himself at too much of a, I mean, this could be a curse for him now, but without putting himself at too much of a risk of accidentally going high when the dynamic changes.
Yeah, I agree. I think Martin, by the way, I love what he's brought to the England team in the last sort of 6 months or so. Like, similar to McCarthy, very similar to McCarthy from an Irish perspective. I think you need that. I go with him. I really like him. I think you just need to have that. You need players who have the ability in attack just to make 1 or 2 yards. You need players in defence just to, when you're like 6, 7, 8 phases into a defensive set, you need somebody who can step up for a momentum shifting hit, which just, and like, not just with the team but with the crowd, like everything, it can be a huge momentum change just having one big shot. Looking at England, like, when they were good going back, I mean, they've shown glimpses, but when you go back all the way 5 years ago now to the 19 World Cup, the players who had like massive momentum shifting moments in the games, then, you know, like, it would be like Underhill, Curry, Genge, Maratoji would step up for loads of big moments. Tuolangi, like, there was so many players who stepped up for those huge physical moments, which is what England were about. Like, we see less of those now, don't we? No, we don't see as many. I think Martin coming back and bringing some of that edge that he brings, it's what England have missed a bit, and I think they need that. So I would hope he plays. I'd love to see George Martin against Joe McCarthy. That would be a phenomenal battle, and that could be like a
you know, that could be like a Lions pairing, you know, looking forward 18 months' time. So that could be great.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of selection headaches for Steve Borthwick, actually more now than he had done, particularly at fly half, Alex, because so there was a squad update Sunday night. We're recording this Monday morning, and it confirmed that Alex Mitchell and Marcus Smith are sort of fully back in the squad, having both had injuries. Smith had his calf pull in out in Girona in the pre-tournament training camp, and Alex Mitchell first started with an affected leg, then picked up a knee injury in the open training session a few Fridays ago. But that in some ways makes it more confusing, doesn't it, having all three tens available? Because Steve Borthwick's been telling us a lot that he's trying to grow cohesion, but keep changing the midfield.
The sense is that England would have started the Six Nations with Marcus Smith at fly half and Finn Smith on the bench. But Marcus Smith drops out, George Ford comes straight in at fly half. And the way that Sam was describing, you know, the importance of territory and an intelligent kicking strategy, I don't see why England would move away from George Ford playing fly half against Ireland. I mean, there were a couple of uncharacteristic passing errors against Scotland, which, you know, normally we would describe George Ford as a guy who makes everyone around him look better. Things weren't clicking. The timing was off a couple of times with George Furbank in particular. And as well as Marcus Smith has played this season, he's not played for 5 weeks. And as highly as I rate Finn Smith and would love to see him get a go, I just don't see why you'd move away from George Ford. Scrum half is different. Mitchell's missed a couple of weeks. I think he will start if he's fit enough to go 70 minutes. I think Alex Mitchell starts, and then you bring back that pairing. But, you know, I don't know what you think, Sam. The guy who needs to run the England strategy in the way that they need to play, I think it's George Ford's game to manage, isn't it?
I agree. Yeah, I 100% agree. I think it's George Ford. He's got that ability. As you mentioned already, you know, the drop goal ability that he's got, I think the kicking strategy, the leadership. I think what the 10 gets the blame for, like, England's inaccuracy. It's not the 10's fault. Like, Owen Farrell is left now. We're sort of seeing similar traits. It's a team collective. And I said this in my column, I'm trying to figure out what it is. Is it because these players, as you said, they play great in the prep. You know, they're brilliant in the prep. But is it they don't practice enough handing skills under enough fatigue because the game is happening too fast? I don't think it's that. I think it's probably more likely, is it there's not enough clarity in their systems, in attacks, so they're kind of unsure whether it's can I push this pass, or is this something that we hold on to, or is the shape not quite there that I was expecting? Where, you know, I mentioned Ireland, like, those forward runners can just flick that ball out the back. They know there's going to be a back there. Now, if it's not 10, it's going to be 12, and if it's not 12, it's going to be 15, and it's not 15, it's blindside wing. Like, somebody will step up into that first receiver role behind that pod always, where you watch any of the team, they get guilty when they get tired and fatigued. That pod of three or four would set up, and then there's no back and behind. Well, that's when, as a frontline defence, you go, great, we'll swallow you up 2v1 because we know there's no option out the back. So that's where Ireland always have that. So I think it's a similar thing. Tens get the flack. It's a team thing why the attack isn't clicking. A 10 will look no good if he's got no go-forward ball, if he's got no runners inside and outside him who are looking genuine. Well, there's not much a 10 can do apart from kick corners. So I think to make Ford or Smith, or going back to Farrell, both Smiths, that is, it's all about the work of the team outside them. The more organised you are, the better your 10 looks, because he's just got 3-4 options every time he's got the ball. So I think it's a team attitude. I feel sorry for the 10s in, and they come under too much criticism. They're probably thinking, they don't want to throw the players under the bus. They're like, throw me a bone here. Like, we haven't got the systems in place. So, yeah, I think it's much more of a team ethos, really, when it comes to handling errors and turnovers. And that clarity needs to get fixed pretty quickly.
It does seem we talked about it on the pod last week, didn't we, Alex, that England are not putting a lot of time into their attacking training. They're focusing a lot on Felix Jones's new blitz defence and getting that right and drilling it and drilling it and drilling it and drilling it. But they're not touching the ball as much as club teams like Northampton and Bath might do. We spoke about that last week, didn't we, that maybe that's part of it. But the other part that I'd like to get your thoughts on, Sam, is perhaps this selection anxiety thing that Alex mentioned in a piece on Monday's paper that Johnny May was talking about on another podcast about, and he was a different type of character. That he said at the World Cup himself that he was always motivated by the fear of failure rather than the sort of positive angled elements of it. But that carousel of midfielders. So last year, if you look at the selections to start at 9, 10, 12 and 13, England had 13 different combinations in 2023, which is an incredible amount. So, Sam, it was different, I guess, for your Wales team because you got to a point where you kind of knew what 10 of the side looked like most weeks, I guess, in for a period of time. But does that play in when you're coming into camp on Monday morning? If you're not sure you're going to play, then more errors come, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing I never wanted was to be complacent. So I never wanted to know I was going to get picked. And having Tipperick in the team and then Martin Williams, I was coming through, I never had complacency, which was a good thing, I think. You know, I think you need that. On the sort of like the error free thing, like Wales, we were by no means the best. You know, we were decent for a period, but like when the press used to come on in a game, we just look at each other and we just go pattern. And everyone just go pattern. Pattern's the call. And pattern just means we just go into our default system, which everybody knows. You trade inside out. It might not have been the most glamorous, but it was error-free. It was error-free and it was direct. And we had players who could kind of deliver it. And look, it seems to suss us out on some of it. But that's where I just wonder, like, I don't know if England have got a default system they go to, which they can all just slip in. It doesn't matter where you are on the field. Somebody shouts the call and everyone just goes, boom, and they just slot in, you know? And it doesn't seem like they have that. And like the 12 thing, and this is again why I will probably defend Steve Borthwick and the coaches. They can't say, probably similar to Gatland now, Gatland can't say, look, I haven't got the player quality that I've got when I'm coaching the Lions or when I've been coaching title teams of the past. Because then you're just going to lose your players. Borthwick can't at the same time go, look, there's been so many combinations because nobody has actually stepped up. So I'm still trying to find someone. Yeah, and he doesn't want to say that probably, and he can't say that. So I don't know, maybe that's for you, boys. Do you think it's... I don't think it's necessarily error in selection. I'm just thinking, he's thinking, God, well, what am I supposed to do? I haven't found someone yet. Nobody's stepped up and been my obvious guy. You know, we've seen hookers do it. We've seen second row step up. We've seen back row step up, play really well. Wingers, but like centre. I'm like, it's just... But no one stepped up, to be fair, in defence to Borthwick. So players have played well for one or two games, but no one's grabbed the bull by the horns and made the decision easy for him, being like, look, I'm your man, I'm 12, and then the rest of the team has to work around me. So I kind of do defend Borthwick on that as well.
I think the periods when England have been at their best, say, since the 2015 World Cup, so 16, 17, and then 19, Eddie Jones... knew that he either had Owen Farrell as his 12 or he had Manu Tuilagi as his 12. If Farrell was 12, Tuilagi would be 13 or Joseph. Like he knew he had two options. Mm. One preferred was Manu at 12 or was Manu at 13, but it wasn't rotating. And at all the periods in between when England have struggled, there's been this conveyor belt of centres coming through, none of whom have quite grabbed it. Like you say, and that I think is why Manu is still in the squad, in the wider training squad now, because he is a sort of a safe default pick if they were to go there. Now, Steve is trying to move away from that reliance on Manu. He didn't pick him from the start in last year's Six Nations when he was fit, but he's always there as a kind of fallback because England, as much as he tries to evolve these things, and we're at a point now where you're arguing something about converting Freddie Stewart to a 12. We know that Richard Hill, a few years ago, was pushing for Ben Earl to be converted to a 12 as he came through the system and was outvoted by Saracens and England. We're looking for answers. Is Tommy Freeman the outside centre? England are now constantly searching for players almost from different positions to try and solve that problem. And I think what Johnny May was referring to was like George Furbank, for example, at 15 different positions, but comes in, plays, doesn't have a, you know, but plays okay, doesn't go perfectly for him, but does well. But now he's immediately thinking, is Freddie Stewart going to come back? Am I going to be dropped again? And Johnny was talking about the uncertainty actually weighs heavily on the mind of the players. And what Will's saying there, this constant search for the answer. I mean, I put in a piece today, it reflects back to the England cricket team of the 90s where there was no consistency of selection because they were constantly searching for an answer. And that is the enemy of the cohesion that you see in the Ireland team, the cohesion that was in your team when you were winning titles. You're constantly striving for something and you almost never allow yourself to give yourself time to find the right answer because you've lost. And so you almost move on again to try and find the next answer. And it's challenging. I completely agree with you, Sam, that the pressure on Steve to, you know, he's trying to find the quality of player that isn't there at the moment. So that therefore leads to a constant rotation of options in the hope that this one might work for this week.
Yeah. Very quickly, we have an email, which we get some emails nowadays, the ruck at thetimes.co.uk, and it will lead me on to a sort of, it's a very good point that Darren has emailed us to make, but it will lead me on to another point I'd like to make. So he was talking about the errors that England made against Scotland, unforced and forced, and he said he went to the England Open training session, took his daughter, who's a keen player for Tennington Girls, and I couldn't get over the number of dropped and wayward passes England players made. I know it's a bit of fun, pats on the back, and good on them for putting it on and getting 10,000 there, but I did find it staggering the number of errors which seem to be taken for granted by both the players and the trainers, which was an interesting point. I was going to say, it maybe leads me on to the sort of irony of this week, as we go back to our initial chat, Sam, is that actually the tight game is the one that wins England this game, isn't it? It's not the lovely attacking shape, maybe. If we're looking at the stats and they're telling us the way to beat Ireland is to play narrow, kick a lot, kick for 1,000 metres, take your goals kind of thing. So it's a funny one, isn't it? But you've got to be clinical when you do get the attacking chance.
So only England will know the answer to this, but like, this is why I thought Rob Howley, for example, just an example of an attack coach who I liked. He recognised that our handling ability wasn't where it should be. We had like a World Cup campaign, I remember, where every single day and every training day, he sort of manufactured drills where, you know, if you're a coach listening to this, if you've got a player going through a drill and he only performs a skill once every 20, 30 seconds, that's not an effective drill. You know, particularly when you've only got a 45, 50-minute session, how can you design drills, and if it's handling drills, where a player is getting a ball through his hands every 5, 10 seconds? And like, how do we just set up these drills where there would be like 50 balls there, and every forward just had to get the ball through his right and left hand, both sides, like 20 times each, 40 passes. But you compound that over months and months and months, you've got hundreds, if not thousands, of catch pass reps, you know, in the bank. And I just wonder, like, you know, is that, I don't think handling ability is due to fatigue or due to the big crowds or pressure or greasy balls. Like, got all the deadwood's whittled out at that point when you get to international level. Like, you know, you don't worry about the crowd, or you're used to playing with wet balls. You played with wet balls since you were six, you know, so you can't use that as an excuse. I think it's just got to be purely down to actual skill set. And if balls are going down, so you've got to train that skill set. But you're right, Alex. Like, you're playing against a really good Irish defence. Ways you play against a really good defence and blitz defence, or two tactics you talk about as players in a sort of tactical meeting would be, well, obviously kicks over the top and just expose the space in behind or out wide, or playing short sides, because teams don't naturally blitz on a short side like they would on an open, because you just have less numbers. You kind of, what you want to do is the defence is you want to shepherd a team to the touchline, and then once you've got a team on the touchline, well, you know they only can come one direction, and that's where you can be so aggressive. So I used to remember, you get a team to a 5 metre channel, they can only play one way, that's when you're so aggressive. So that's why teams on short sides don't tend to be too aggressive, because they'll shepherd them to a touchline and then they'll come off. But it's a very good tactic that when you are playing teams who like to blitz, just bounce down the short side. New Zealand do it a lot. You know, they're great at doing that. It just goes away from that aggressive defence. So, yeah, you've got to be smart with it. And that's why I think someone like Ford won't get carried away. He'll sort of stick to game plan, go short side, turn wingers, kick them, kick in behind. Hopefully they try and kick back and it comes off their boot and you've suddenly got an attacking line out. Twickenham raises. Like, you've got to try and, what Ireland are excellent at and what the good teams are good at, a lot of the game isn't always trying to score. It's trying to force errors out of opposition, which is why I think the territory game is so important, which is why keep putting them back into their 22. Go on, have another 5 metre exit. Let's have a look at you. Go on, have another scrum. Play three phases and kick, and we'll put big pressure on you. That's what England did when they played Wales. They kept kicking the ball into Wales 22. Wales tried to play out one phase too many. England scrum, Ben Earl, pick and go, try. And that try, because it was a great try, Ben Earl was like Lawrence Taddeo. Yeah, it was a good try. But it came from actually forcing Wales to overplay and make mistakes. I think that's probably, Ireland will be better than Wales, obviously, but I think that's how England should try and play the game at home. Just try and keep suffocating Ireland, keep putting them back, and then see how smart they are.
Sam, can I just rewind to you, just something you said there about the Rob Howley handling session? You got me thinking. You said that there's only a limited amount of time, which there is. I understand that a team training session is put on the clock because everything is measured and they want to train at an intensity that matches or is above a test match. And the full team training sessions are, yeah, there's a countdown clock on the corner of England's pitch, and I get that. But as you said there, skill set, it just needs to be honed all the time. And the goal kickers then stick around after the team training session to practice their goal kicks. And you're not going to have, George Ford's not going to turn up at Twickenham on Saturday having kicked three times, you know, literally three times a goal at the training at Pennyhill Park in the week. Why is it that attacking skill sets like just being comfortable passing off both hands would have to be counted within a limited time? That they're in camp all day. It's not hugely onerous, I wouldn't have thought, on physically to just be practicing the accuracy of their passes, and then you can get creative with how you do it, whether it's a, you know, around the dining room or whatever. Just make it fun. But why would England be focusing on defence so much more at the expense of doing any of that kind of training at all, when it's not really physically taxing, but it's the accuracy that the goal kickers would spend extra time doing. So why?
Well, the hookers too.
Why isn't anyone else doing that?
You should be an international coach. No, you're right. You're bang right. And I'll tell you an example why you're right. And this is what I mean, where only England know what they're doing. And you're absolutely spot on, Alex. What Wales would do on a Monday, when you are a little bit banged up, you can't really go through the high-speed meters that you want to, we would set up in our indoor pitch exactly what you said, because you can still find time to work handling without having to go through fatigue. So, yeah, you're 100% right. So we would have, like, try to explain it. We'd have, like, balls which had, like, maybe some of them might be weighted balls. We'd have balls which are odd shape. You know, like, you've got, imagine, like, a V, I don't know how to pick, like on a ground. So like imagine, so you've got like a net, which is at a 45 degree angle. And there's a net at the other side at 45. And you'd throw the balls at it, almost like cricket catching.
Yeah, cricket catching machine thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And we'd throw, so we'd like what you're saying. We'd do that. We'd get odd shaped balls, rugby balls, footballs. Somebody would throw it from behind us. We didn't know which direction it was coming from. And they'd be just launching balls. We're just there, catch, pass. And like just hand-eye coordination skill set. And you're right, that takes up, no running meters, you stood still, but it's all just catch pass, hand-eye coordination. So you absolutely can train it without team sessions. And that's where you think, oh, I'd hope England would be doing that sort of thing, because it does look like an aureus skill set error. Wales, we made massive changes, probably from when we went through that real physical era of 11, 12, 13. From then, we tried to evolve. We did a lot more of this handling stuff. And like you see Wales players now, they're all very comfortable catch pass and handling. Wales actually look better when we do that. But yeah, that they find time to do handling reps in the week, which isn't fatiguing. So when you go to the session, then you can focus on the team. So, I mean, if England aren't doing any work like that, you think they are missing the trick, and you're right to think like that. But I think the good teams and the smart teams, they can factor in handling ability and catch pass stuff when it's not under sort of immense fatigue then. So yeah, you should definitely try and structure windows in the week where you can do that, so you can top up your handling skills for sure.
So, lads, love that chat. Really fascinating. We better move on to cover some of the other games. So, why don't we park England Ireland there? Are we going to do a little prediction? Is it? I remember this reminds me of our chat, Sam, the last time you were on the pod about England playing South Africa in the semi final. I think that point we said it's probably 8 out of 10 South Africa win, 2 out of 10 England win.
Oh, what did I say? I can't remember. Do you remember what I said?
I think we've all agreed basically that England have about a 20% chance of winning that game, and they got close, didn't they? Right.
Well, we did all say that they've got a much closer chance than the bookies thought they had.
Yeah,
this because they had toast. This is a rewind pod, but they'd spent 6 weeks, 2 months building for one game against Africa, and they were going to be better in that game than in any game previously. I think the bookies had a spread of like 11 points or something, and we all said that they would get within that.
So is it further away then? This time, is it 10% England, 90% Ireland?
21
this
points the bookies have.
Which is crazy.
21?
Yeah, I think so.
Is it 21?
For an England home game. Yeah. Well, weirdly, the England-Ireland matches haven't actually been that close. Whoever's won them over the last 5 or 6 attempts have all been about 15-plus points. They've not been tight ones like Scotland-England games.
That was my gut feeling. Like you said then, 21, Alex. So they're pretty good, those betting sort of companies, aren't they, getting close? Like, I did think that was kind of the ball. I don't ever look at those because I've never betted in my life. But coming into this, that's why I said it right at the top, where I thought, oh, are they going to win every game by 20 points? Like, I wouldn't be surprised. I if a team can come within 14 points of Ireland, they've done well. And I do agree with Tommy. I do think the standard isn't maybe as good elsewhere in the championship compared to Ireland. But yeah, to your point, Will, 90-10. 90-10, like 10%.
That's not the scoreline, that's the percentage. We're just, sorry. Just
yeah, let me make that clear, percentage. Yeah, I mean, if England hit an emotional peak and, you know, you can never rule out things like a red card from Ireland, even though they are very well disciplined. All these things can happen, but I do think a lot will have to go England's way for them to get a win in Twickenham.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's park England-Ireland there. And after this, we'll chat about the other two games coming up, Wales-France and Italy-Scotland.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, so small matter of a couple of pretty decent games as away from England against Ireland. So Italy-Scotland, let's look at that. So for years and years and years, as Mark Palmer has said on many of our pods, this Six Nations, it used to be the Six Nations death match. Sam, no way that's going to be this time, right? I mean, we've looked at it and thought Italy have got a win in them, the Six Nations, and they should have had one against France last time out. But Scotland aren't losing there, are they?
I think Scotland are too good. I know people will be like, well, they've still lost a game. Scotland should be 3-3. I know we're not going to revisit that try. That should have been a try. That wasn't a try. Scotland know they're good enough to be 3-3, and they should go to Italy and win. Now, Italy are much improved compared to the Italian team, which I've been critical of in the past maybe 2, 3, 4 years. They're vastly different, kicking a lot more in their own half, still run themselves into a little bit of trouble. But Scotland, I think, are outright the second best team in this championship at the minute, and Scotland should go to Italy. Yeah, Italy will cause some problems, and I think in the attack they can look nice, but I expect a Scotland win out there, yeah.
It's going to be a sellout crowd as well. As in, I think if you're on Mark Palmer's Twitter account, which you should be, he was telling us the other day that 65,000, they don't have the full capacity for rugby games sometimes at the Stadio Olimpico, but that's a great effort, isn't it? It seems like something is growing with the Italian rugby.
It is. I mean, we've been there, we were there earlier this season. The visiting fans always bump up the crowd at the Stadio Olimpico, but even said, I've always been amazed at how loyal that Italian fan base have been.
Incredible, yeah.
Because they always get a big crowd at the Olimpico, even if half of them are England fans for an England game, say, and they've got 55,000 there. There's still 25,000 odd hardy Italian fans turning up every week. And for most of the last 20 odd years, it's been to watch their team lose. They will be rocking up in Rome on the weekend with a real belief that this Italy team can claim a scalp. Like it just feels like there's a really big win in them, and it should have been against France. You know, we can debate the last penalty and should have been retaken. I think that should have been a win for Italy, but that would just give them all hope that they can do it against Scotland, which would be brutal for Scotland, because as Sam said, they should be 3-3. But see, it's heartening for the championship. It's heartening for Italian rugby that this game's a sellout. They'll turn up thinking that they've got a really good shot at winning the game, and the under-20 team are rolling teams like France in the under-26 nations, which just, as we discussed with Mark last week, they've got a pyramid building there. They're picking off some bigger name players, recruiting qualified players like Louis Leiner. I don't know if he's going to play this week. Paolo Adogru, who's currently injured, but they've also got a pathway that is creating successful under 20 teams, and you hope at some point that that will start rewarding that loyal fan base in Italy with the wins that they definitely deserve for rocking up every week and over the last 20 years.
What's impressing you about the Italian stuff this season, Sam?
Well, the one thing I'm really pleased with Italy is, gone are the days now you can make 6-7 changes and just expect to win. You can't do that now, that you will come under an almighty banana skin. But you know, I was always very surprised. Yes, attacking-wise, they were great last year under Kieran Crowley. They played some brilliant attack in rugby, probably second to Ireland. From when you're looking at their shape and some of the tries they scored was brilliant. But they were so stubborn in running the ball out, like so stubborn. And like two or three tries they conceded a game, you'd be like, well, that's from overplaying in your own half and you've got turned over, then you've given up a penalty or a kick to the corner. So I think this year it seems like they're kicking from their half a lot more. They still get caught sometimes, like trying to play maybe one or two phases too many, happened against France, particularly in that first half when the French looking a bit better and they capitalised on those errors that the Italians made. But if they can just like, I'm not saying you never kick in your own half, but you should, as long as if it's your default to get out of your half as soon as you can, but every time you do just scan to see if it's on, then that's fine. And if it's on, you can go and play. You have that license, absolutely. But if they just cut out of their half most of the times, then like that would solve so many of their problems, and then they can just play in the right areas. So I've seen a bit more of that this year, which is why we're sort of seeing them come, excluded Ireland, obviously, because they were just exceptional that game, Ireland, when they beat them 36-0. Excluded Ireland, that's why I think they've been a lot closer in these games. They're just playing just a bit smarter rugby than they were last year, and that's been, I think, relatively a quicker fix for Italy. So that's really good to see.
Here's a stat for you both. And I've just done a quick rattle through, so I believe this is right. But the last time Scotland won four matches in the Six Nations, do you want to have a guess when that was?
I'd say early 90s, was it?
Very early 90s. Like the last time they won a Grand Slam, 1990. Because 99, they won the Five Nations with three wins out of four matches. So obviously, yeah, as you said, Sam, they should be 3 from 3. But going four wins would be remarkable in this tournament, because that is basically meaning they'd beat Ireland. But they've got to keep winning, haven't they, to keep the pressure on. And as we've said on previous pods, Scotland have never gone into the final weekend of a Six Nations with a chance of a title. And actually, Ireland might deny them that this time if only get a bonus point win in England. They've already won the title with a week to go because no one can catch them on 20 points. But have you seen a lot of progress in the Scottish, Sam, you think, this season?
Yeah, I think a lot of teams, I think, well, it's difficult to compare South Africa and the World Cup because there's no team like South Africa in the Six Nations. But again, like, I don't think England could just say, which they haven't, obviously their record's been pretty poor, but England in particular, Wales used to rely on this a lot as well. Speaking from experience, you can't just play Scotland now and go, oh, we're going to beat them physically and win. That doesn't really happen anymore. I think their physical side of the game has gone up, and they've got genuine X factor that can just pull something out of the bag in the game, which is you need that in your team. Like, I remember there would be big games I'd be playing in, and the coach would be like, some of you in here now are gonna have to step up for a big moment, because when the teams are this tight and everything's in the balance, like, sometimes it is just about how many world-class players have you got compared to them, how many boys can step up for, you know, like a Van der Merwe has done, or like a Tui Pulotu, for example, who can step up for like that big moment when the game's in the balance in the 75th minute. Scotland got those players now. You know, before it might have been too much reliance on Hogg and Russell maybe, but now I think there's a lot of players who have a huge influence on the game. So I think given their increase in physicality, which Steve Tandy's done a great job as a defence coach and has got them really like toughened. Speaking to some coaches who got up to Scotland, I think that's probably maybe like the challenge of them was to get them as excited to defend as they were to attack. They've always been quite happy with ball in hand, but it's flipping it around to the other side. They've got that now, and they've got some X factor and world-class players in their team. I think that's what's probably tipped the scales for them slightly in their favour. Now they are one of the top three sides in the championship quite consistently now, I think, going forward.
Okay, so why don't we move on to Wales-France? So, Sam, have Wales got enough to unsettle the wobbly French? Because this has been a kind of one of the newsy stories of the tournament.
I think Wales will win. The reason being is, I'll tell you why. Wales have actually looked quite comfortable ball in hand. I know it's been when they've been behind, but when they ball in hand, I think they've got enough proof to themselves now to go, look, we can play. They look at the last three games they've played in. Like, look, when we play, we can really stress teams. Well, Wales are actually very good. They don't make massive meters in attack. They don't have the big ball carriers that a lot of other teams have, like France, for example. But what they are very good at is if teams want to play direct off Wales and play just off nine, Wales are very good at swallowing that up. Very aggressive defence. Players really pride themselves on that. So we say, wait, like looking at the French team now, if they just want to slam up Antonio and they've got, you know, Cyril Bailly, Aldrin, they just want to run those guys up off nine with little deception, you know, like, so not many options outside of that. Wales are quite happy with that. That's why Wales are normally always in the arm wrestle with South Africa, because they're quite good at staying in arm wrestles and playing that tight game and just rolling up the sleeves. That's like, you know, that's kind of where the lads have all come from. That's their background. You know, they're all like tough lads, all just defend all day and just go until they drop. So I think if France come with that kind of mindset, they just want to monster Wales, then Wales will, I think, will do okay and they'll be able to counter them and be quite good. But if France managed to click, and like it did look like before Jalibert went off, like Jalibert would get the ball from deep and he'd suddenly just like hitch kick, run across field and try and throw big passes, and like that sort of open, loose style that France play, I think is any team finds hard to contain. But yeah, if France just want to go direct against Wales, I think Wales will swallow that up. They'll absorb that pressure, and then I think they'll be able to play some nice rugby. The only big challenge for me would be with Wales, would be scrum time. If France just like, which they did first half against Italy, if they just absolutely rip the scrum apart like they did against Italy, it is so difficult. It's so difficult to get back out of that. But I'll put it out there. I expect Wales to win the next two games, so I think they'll beat France. How do you boys think it'll go?
I was going to ask you, I'm interested in that the first half of the Scotland game and the first half of last week's game against Ireland, where they sort of get blitzed and then find their feet too late, and they had that nice patch start the second half against Ireland and obviously the whole second half against Scotland, and yet the England game was a bit different. I just feel if they can they can sort of find themselves early enough in the game, and I wonder whether it's just about an identity of, yeah, this is a brand new team with young players. They need to start well in order to impose themselves on the game and maybe gain that belief, yeah, we can play here, we're okay, we don't need to start doing it when the game's gone and we're 20 points down. If they can start well, and I wonder, having never been there obviously, but whether when you're that young and you're that fresh as a team, that you need a foothold in the game early. And if you get it, if Wales get that foothold early, whether it's a, you know, it's dealing with what France throw at them, whether it's kicking a couple of, going 3-6, they might feel, yeah, we can do this. We're in this game, and they don't kind of get swept aside for half an hour before they find themselves, and then the game's gone. Which against England, I think they did that well. Like they were in the, they had a foothold in the game, but in the other two, they haven't. And is that a symptom of new players fresh to the test environment, not quite understanding how they fit together yet as a team, do you think, Sam? They need that foothold early to just gain an identity and a feeling that, yeah, we can do this today.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's time in the saddle and like dealing with pressure. Like a lot of those guys that first game against Scotland, with Scotland coming down, a lot of people are sort of talking them up again. You know, a lot of those players that first start an experience in a Six Nations game, like it can be very overwhelming. And it's kind of like, rather than taking it in, it's kind of like making sure you still have the mindset to throw the first punch and not wait to be punched. You know, where it feels like Wales have waited to be punched and then they've come back. And the reason they've played well in the second halves of Scotland and Ireland is because, let's be honest, the pressure's been off. If you're down by 20 points, well, if you're down by 25, it's not a huge difference compared to being down by 20. So let's have a go. So I think it's just realising that international rugby, there is always that risk reward, and you know, it's, and things are going to be under the microscope. And the more you get used to that pressure, the more you get used to that scrutiny, then I think the easier it is to express yourself and not to dwell on it. So now they've got three games in the bank. You know, they go to England, probably would have been slightly different emotionally given the fact that it was England. England probably aren't firing as people would be expecting to, as they probably smelt blood a little bit there. But I think probably Scotland and Ireland, they almost like waited till they got punched first to sort of fire back. Where I think now it's like, right, okay, lads, you've had three games under the belt. You know, they've played in some real tough test cauldrons, Twickenham, Dublin, you know, even playing a lot of some of their first games in the Six Nations at home in the Principality. It's like, right, now now is the time you exert yourself. You know, we've done some learning now over the past sort of month or two. Now they have to express themselves early on. And say as a coach, like, look, if you try something the first 20 that goes wrong, I'm not going to blame you. I'm not going to drop you because we have to do these things. We can't just be too conservative and expect to win games. So I think as long as the players sort of don't feel under pressure to make errors now they've got some experience under the belt, I think they should do a job against France. If they, for some reason, still look like rabbits in the headlights in the first half, and I don't know, but something's going wrong. You know, something's going wrong in the environment. But I'd like to think now that they'll hopefully throw the first punch against France.
I would also feel that even if France start quickly, their mentality's fragile at the moment. They're
seeing shadows a bit more.
They've lost a whole layer of assistant coaches underneath Fabien Galthié. They've now lost their... Well, they don't have either of their first two fly halves. They obviously don't have the best player in the world because he's off winning sevens titles in the US.
Donty, 5-week ban.
Donty's banned too.
Italy.
I would think that this is a week where Gatland's the environment that Gatland sets for his team could be really important, because even if France start quickly, I think he will have drilled into Wales that they are vulnerable and to not allow it to get away from them, because they can land a counter punch which could actually knock France over much more easily than France can knock Wales over.
It's remarkable.
I can imagine Gatland showing in team training, because I'm watching France, I'm seeing it a lot. Now, for all their weight and brute force, like every pro, there's a con, right? That is a serious asset they have. Scrum time, using the Tony or five-man lineouts to carry in the tens, like, you know, it's a weapon, you know. But like you look at when when you watch the TV and the camera angle goes wide, it goes to that big angle where you see the full pitch, and they're showing that kick battle. Like when you're watching France, just look at the middle of the pitch and just look at kind of like the work rate of the forwards. And like, there's some gas forwards in there. Like, I know people say France play high tempo, but they don't. I wouldn't say they're that fit. You can't be that fit. If you're 140, 130 kilo, you can't be as fit, and you're finding it hard to get around the pitch compared to someone who's 120 kilo. So I think it's just being like, look, we have to play the game at quite a high ball in play time. When you say high tempo doesn't mean high risk, miss two passes, things like that. High tempo means running to lineouts, trying to keep the ball on the field, trying to be good ball retention, so you're sort of making them defend a lot. Good discipline in defence, so you're not giving away penalties where they can slow the game down, kick to the corner. That's what high tempo means. Wales need to play a low error, high tempo game to make this French team and French pack struggle, because they do find it hard to move around. It's just the moments of brilliance from counter-attack where we see a couple of offloads and a 50-metre try. We go, oh, France play at such tempo. It's like, well, no, they counter-attack at tempo, but they don't play a massive amount of the game at tempo, if that makes sense. So I think the Wales need to try and up that tempo and try and pick on maybe some of those forwards who won't be as fit as some of the Welsh lads.
Even if France aren't where they have been, it would still be a huge belief result, Sam, wouldn't it, for a young Welsh team, even though they're at home as well, but to say, right, we've just toppled France, who won a slam two tournaments ago.
Massive. I mean, I would actually consider this tournament a bit of a... I know it shows where Wales have come from, where they are now, so I don't want to sound like the heroic loser. I always hated the heroic loser tag, but you've got to be realistic where Wales are at the minute. If Wales won the next two games, I'd be pretty happy, actually. I think that would be quite a successful tournament. I'd be like, well, yeah, they've really thrown the kitchen sink at England for an hour. They nearly bounced back to Scotland after a poor start. Ireland is just Ireland. Just have to accept that Ireland are quite far ahead in their journey compared to Wales. If Wales beat France, that could be a huge catalyst. And you sometimes, as a young team, you believe in yourself, but you need a result to really back up that claim and to really then drive that belief even further. Once you have that evidence, then you can use that then to as confidence moving forward, and it changes the psyche. So I do think a big win against France, which it would be a big win, it'd be a massive win. If you said to me in the World Cup, Wales would beat France at home next year, I probably would have said that wasn't going to happen, but I think it can happen. If Wales got that, I think that could be, well, that's a huge turning point. I'm not saying Wales are going to suddenly turn into a championship team. That won't happen that quickly, but I think it would be a huge turning point for the belief and psyche for the squad building for the next couple of years.
And it would be just very quickly on the French side of things, like, if France lose, they're then one from four, which is absolutely absurd, isn't it, really? Wales would go above them in the table. Okay, that's an unbelievable turnaround from probably deign to win the World Cup and don't, and now they could come fifth in the Six Nations, maybe even bottom if Italy pull out a result in the last two. Blimey. Well, there we go. So we're all thinking Wales win. So yep. Sam, I'll let you into my girlfriend's family do a predictions game thing, which I'm usually terrible at, which is not great for the ego and like my job being someone who should know a bit about rugby. But before the tournament, I did all my predictions, and this weekend I've gone rogue. But I did say Wales to beat France, 20 points to 19. So there you go. I've also got an England win and an Italy win, which doesn't look likely now. But there you go. Right, so those are the games. That Wales-France one's the Sunday match for people tuning in on the telly. The other two are the Saturday games. So why don't we round off the pod after a small little break. We've got to go this a week, and then we'll finish up. Okay, guys, so another email's dropped in, which we're very grateful to have, from Alex McGee, who says he's a Scotland fan, and he was talking about Ireland. We actually touched on this with Tommy Boat earlier. He was saying, my brother and I have been talking a lot about this and wonder if Jack Crowley is the more important ingredient than the increased physicality of the pack, particularly with Joe McCarthy. And he's saying, is there an argument that their unwillingness to consider a route that was different to Sexton narrowed their play and missed out on creating the same capabilities they have across the rest of the side? He's kind of basically saying, should they have moved Johnny Sexton on earlier?
Well, that's what Tommy said, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Particularly at that quarterfinal when he was clearly out on his feet. The reluctance to throw Jack Crowley on, you'll never know what difference it might have made. But in hindsight, you'd think they probably should have done. Fresher legs, fresher brain. You can understand why they stuck with Johnny Sexton for as long as they did, because for all the reasons that Tommy explained, that how important he was behind the scenes, he ran everything, I guess a bit in the same way that O'Farrell did with England. But if you narrow it right down onto that World Cup quarterfinal and you look what Jack Crowley's done since, you do have to wonder whether that the kind of inaction in the coaching box ultimately cost them.
It was that, Sam, we were watching it. Where were you for that quarterfinal weekend? Were you down south or were you in Paris?
I was meant to be there, but my flight got cancelled.
Oh, no.
Some of that strike stuff. So that's why George Gregan ended up randomly doing a Wales game. And I was like, why is George Gregan? I couldn't make it. Like, guys, I'm stuck. I'm not going to make it. I'm stuck in Gatwick. So I missed it. So I ended up driving home. Yeah. So
right. Because I remember, Alex, we were watching that because we were doing the Marseille quarterfinals. Yeah. England were in the Sunday one against Fiji.
That's right.
And Wales played the Saturday one against Argentina. And the Ireland game was after the Wales one. And we were watching it in a pub afterwards, weren't we? And then it was just that, what was it, 30-odd phase move where Ireland were like, are they going to drop goal? Are they going to score a try? Are they going to do it? And they just didn't. They were sort of going through the pattern without ever actually getting somewhere with it, weren't they?
Yeah, it wasn't penetrative enough. It almost wasn't. They just lacked a spark at that point.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, it's a good point. And I think Tommy addressed it earlier. You do wonder whether when you've got someone who's that important to the setup, but it just narrowed their thinking slightly. I mean, yeah. It sounds really harsh to say so because they're going for back-to-back slams, and the first one of those slams, Johnny was the 10.
Yeah, and like one of the greatest all-time Ireland players of all. But there you go. So, okay, thanks very much to Alex for that email. It wasn't Alex Lowe, it was Alex McGee, our friend from Scotland. So why don't we do a quick God or Goddess of the Week? And we're always a bit different, these ones, in fallow weekends when there's still rugby happening but not Six Nations stuff.
I'm going to look far and wide for our...
Well, I'm going to go for a goddess for mine, actually, and a referee. Amy Barrett-Theron, who's a South African referee, who's doing a URC match, and she dealt very well with quite disrespectful Bongi Mbonambi, who was questioning her decision-making. She was basically like, look, I've got a lot of respect for you, so why don't you have some respect for me? And it was a nice little cut him at the knees when he was being a bit over the top. But if people remember, she was also the same referee who went viral for the England under-20s, Wales under-20s, where she said, I'm not mad, I'm just disappointed. Oh, yeah. You guys gave me buy-in in the changing rooms. Are you lying to me? So respect to Amy Barrett-Theron, who was in the URC refereeing. Sam, you mentioned Reece Patchell down in Super Rugby. Is he going to be your nomination?
Yeah,
for the Islanders?
I mean, I'll be honest, I've probably been over this following week, I've been casting an eye moreover what's been happening from either the Welsh teams or the Welsh players that are maybe playing rugby, just a bit of a weekend off. But I have It has caught my eye. And he is a friend of mine. He's a good friend of mine anyway. Played with him a lot. But Rhys Patchell, it's a nice story because he wasn't offered a contract in Wales given the sort of financial situation, the regions are in our budget cut. So he had to leave. So he ended up playing in, he's playing for the Highlanders in Super Rugby. And Lee Halfpenny's another one. He's gone over to Crusaders to play. But Patchell, and I remember thinking, what a move. Because Patchell is a 10. I'm not just saying this. I mentioned he's a friend. So I'm not saying because he's a friend. He's one of the most gifted attacking players I've ever played with. You know, just skill set, catch pass, kicking, pace. You know, like just such a brilliant, he's probably a victim of his own versatility. But he's been playing 10 at the Highlanders. And if anybody just wants to look at some clips, just go on like Super Rugby's Instagram channel. Patchell, 2 weekends ago, had an absolute worldie of a pass, which created a try. And then he's had another one this weekend, an absolute amazing out the back door offload, which created another try. I bet the Highlanders are thinking, oh my goodness, you've got a killer of a signing here. He suits Super Rugby down to the ground and he's super fit. He's one of the fittest players in the squad, so he'll run all day, just like the Kiwis. And he sort of said that. I didn't realise how high the skill set and how high the tempo was in New Zealand, but that suits him. So my God of the Week is going to go to Rhys Patchell. He's gone all the way to the other side of the world to play, and he's ripping up trees for the Highlanders.
I quite enjoyed the return of early morning Super Rugby.
Yeah.
Put the coffee pot on, and Crusaders losing at the Waratahs. You know, Scott Robertson's no longer there. They lost. And
they haven't won. They're 0-2, aren't they?
2, yeah. Yeah, fascinating. And I mean, my nomination won't come from Super Rugby, but I've got to give a shout out to Celestino Ravatumada, the Fijian draw winger.
Yeah.
Who, again, just look him up on social. There are different ways to play the game, and the Fiji draw are pretty much dedicated to the most exciting way of playing the game. And his exits from the 22, the tries he scored, the line breaks he made for Fiji draw are just electric. So I definitely recommend looking at that. But we've got to name check. I said him earlier, Antoine Dupont. France haven't won a sevens tournament
since 2005.
There you go, 19 years. Leading France to the series win in LA this weekend. And he's just, I always thought he would be a good sevens player because he's an unbelievable rugby player. But he's straight up to speed with the fitness. He's running away from full-time sevens players. You know, he can find space on a 15s pitch. He's just carving it up in sevens. And first World Series title in 19 years. And it's no coincidence that the Dupont is at the heart of it.
Crazy. Wherever he goes, he has success. And it sounds premature to say it, but he has to be. Even if he finished playing now, it's almost like that Barry John thing with Wales. Like Barry John finished like, what, 27 or something. Dupont, I think, is about 27 now. If he finished now, you'd have to just say, look, you can't compare eras, but you have to say he is without doubt one of the greatest players of all time already. Just what an athlete. Wherever he goes, brings success with him.
And, yeah. And I do think that if he's just moved to sevens just because of the challenge of winning a gold medal, brilliant. If the French Olympic Committee have, you know, paid him to switch codes, I have no idea, then it'll be money well spent because already he's having a massive impact. And if he's if doing this is to bring eyeballs and sponsor money, presumably, onto the Olympics in Paris later this year, then it's already working because I think everyone's excited to watch him play.
Yeah, and seemingly just from bits and pieces on social media, a whole load of French journalists have gone out there. Like it's on telly now in the UK on TNT Sports as well. And like Dupont Factor's bringing it back, which is great. It's great. That's what we want. Star power, isn't it? Brings people together. Right, everyone. That has been another Ruck from the Times and the Sunday Times. Another round of Six Nations incoming, and we'll have loads of analysis and insight and chat next Monday to talk through it all. But for now, really appreciate the time Sam Warburton spent with us. Thanks very much, Sam.
Thanks, guys. Good to be on here again. Thanks for having me.
We're going to read your column with interest on the weekend. You don't need to reveal what it is yet because you might not know yourself. But
cool. Well, I'm actually organised it now. Yeah, so I don't know exactly what it is yet.
And Alex will be at England Ireland, but watching all the other ones too. So for now, please keep emailing us if you'd like to. If you've heard anything we've chatted about and agree or disagree, email theruck@thetimes.co.uk or anything crops up over the weekend, give us a shout. We'll have a look next Monday into the mailbag. But for now, thanks for listening. Like and subscribe, follow, tell all your friends wherever you get your podcast from. But for now, goodbye.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.